Usually when we talk about a medical diagnosis, there's this comforting expectation of precision.
Right. It feels like engineering.
Yeah, exactly. Like
Yeah.
if you break your arm, you go to the hospital, they put you in a machine, and the X-ray produces this undeniable image. You see that jagged white line across the bone, and the doctor just points at the screen and says, "Well, there it is. That's the problem."
It's entirely binary. I mean, the bone is broken or the bone is intact, the ligament is torn or it is not.
Right. And as humans, we love that. We crave that kind of visible, categorized certainty. When things go wrong, we want a tangible villain we can point to. But then you step into the world of human performance.
Oh, yeah. That's a whole different ball game.
It really is. You step into the realm of cognitive load, the psychology of high-stakes environments, the moments where you have to perform under immense pressure, and suddenly that X-ray machine is completely useless. We are looking at a diagnostic landscape that is honestly, incredibly murky. So, welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are taking a fascinating journey into the architecture of the human mind when it is pushed to its absolute limits.
And we're going to use an incredibly detailed manual on the mental game of ice hockey to do it.
Yes, the mental game learning to play the game. And I love that we are using this specific material today because usually when you hear the phrase sports psychology, you expect some guy yelling at you to, visualize winning or just want it
Well,
more.
the mystical rah-rah motivation stuff.
Exactly. But this manual doesn't do that at all. It treats the brain on the ice like an applied cognitive science.
Which is exactly why this framework is so powerful. I mean, we are going to build a durable mental model today. The goal here isn't just to give you, the listener, a list of hockey tips.
Right, we're going way deeper than that.
Exactly. By the end of our conversation, you will understand the underlying mechanics of human attention, the biological reality of how confidence is built, and the physical architecture of anxiety.
And more importantly, you'll know how to apply these frameworks not just on a sheet of ice, but in literally any high-pressure environment you navigate in your own life.
Yeah, whether that is a boardroom presentation, a high-stakes negotiation, or honestly, simply managing a chaotic household. We are going to break this down progressively, looking at the root causes of performance failure.
But before we get into the actual mechanics of the brain under pressure,
No.
we really need to define our boundaries. We have to establish what the mental game actually is. Because I feel like there is this pervasive, almost toxic misconception in pop culture that if you just manifest hard enough or visualize perfectly, you are magically going to become a superstar.
Oh, we have to dismantle that myth immediately. The mental game does not raise your peak physical performance. It is not alchemy.
Right.
I mean, if you have a fundamentally flawed wrist shot, all the sports psychology in the world will not fix your mechanics. It's not going to make you skate faster than your raw physical biology allows.
So what does it actually do?
What the mental game actually does is close the gap between your absolute worst performance and your absolute best performance.
Okay. So it is a tool for consistency. We are raising the floor, not the ceiling.
That is the perfect way to look at it. Think about a day when you performed terribly at a task where you normally excel. Assuming you weren't physically ill or injured, your physical capabilities didn't just vanish overnight.
Right, my muscles didn't suddenly forget how to work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Your central nervous system didn't lose its motor pathways. So if the physical hardware was intact, what actually fluctuated?
I guess my focus.
Yes. What fluctuated was your attention, your composure, and the speed of your decision making. That is where the variance lives. That's what we were trying to control.
I find that incredibly empowering, actually.
Yeah.
You aren't trying to magically become a different person. You're just trying to consistently access the skills you already possess.
Exactly.
Now, as someone who loves looking at how we know what we know, the epistemology of a subject, there is a feature of this source material that I find absolutely fascinating.
The three buckets.
Yes, in the sports world, a lot of advice is just passed down through generations like folklore. But this manual rigorously separates its claims into three distinct buckets of evidence.
And that separation is vital for building a trustworthy mental model.
Right, so bucket one is peer-reviewed research, meaning massive meta-analyses and highly replicated scientific findings. Bucket two is what they call thin evidence, meaning maybe there is a small study out there or the topic is highly contested among academics.
Right. And bucket three is coaching craft. which refers to the untested but universally applied wisdom of experienced practitioners.
Stuff that hasn't necessarily been in a lab.
Exactly. It hasn't been subjected to a double-blind, randomized controlled trial in a university, but it has survived the brutal filter of working in the real world over decades. We aren't going to dismiss coaching craft today, but we are going to label our buckets clearly.
So whenever we introduce a concept, you, the listener, will know exactly how heavy a weight you can put on it, whether it is backed by robust scientific consensus or if it is just a highly effective practical tool.
Right. So let's set the stage then. Let's talk about why context matters, because the environment dictates the mental adaptation.
And we are using ice hockey as our crucible today.
Yeah. And when you look at the unique demands of ice hockey, it is an unusually unforgiving environment for a wandering mind. It's really a perfect storm for cognitive overload.
How so?
Well, if we look at this through the lens of cognitive load theory, hockey isolates and attacks the brain's executive functions in a way very few other environments do. First, consider the continuous nature of the action.
Right. It never really stops.
Exactly. In American football, you have a burst of violence and then a huddle where the brain can reset. In baseball, the game is heavily segmented. But in hockey, the situation on the ice changes entirely every 2 to 3 seconds.
Wow. Every 2 to 3 seconds.
Yeah. A puck deflects, a player falls, a transition occurs. There is no moment where the game pauses and waits for your brain to catch up to the new reality.
I have always thought of it as playing speed chess on a treadmill while people are actively shouting at you.
That analogy captures the dual task nature perfectly.
You have to make these geometric, tactical calculations, but your heart rate is at 180 beats per minute.
And to add to the stress of that treadmill, the feedback you receive for a mistake is incredibly public and immediate.
Oh, yeah.
In many professions, a misread or a bad decision might not be discovered for weeks. Even in other sports, a slight miscalculation might just cost you a yard of field position.
But in hockey?
In hockey, a blown defensive coverage often results in a red light flashing, a horn blaring at over 100 decibels, and a goal with your name on it visible to everyone in the arena. There is absolutely nowhere to hide. The shame of a mistake is instantaneous.
And we haven't even talked about the physical fatigue yet. The research tells us that a standard shift in hockey is incredibly short, measured at roughly 30 to 80 seconds.
Right. And it is that short because the physical output is maximal. You're essentially sprinting on steel blades, engaging in isometric wrestling matches along the boards, and changing direction violently.
Which has to create a fascinating biological paradox, right?
Yeah. It absolutely does. Because the shift is so exhausting, the hardest, most complex decisions almost always occur in the final 10 seconds of that shift.
When you're completely gassed.
Exactly. This is the exact moment when your legs are filled with lactic acid and your brain is genuinely starved of oxygen. Your working memory capacity is at its lowest, but the tactical demands of the game are often at their highest.
Because that is usually when you are trapped in your own defensive zone trying to clear the puck.
Right. Mental discipline has to stand in for judgment when you are simply too tired to think clearly.
Let's do a quick retrieval prompt for our listener right here, just to lock in this foundational concept before we move on.
Yeah.
Think about what we just discussed regarding the physical versus the mental. If your physical skills, your top speed, your physical strength, your mechanical shooting ability do not fluctuate wildly from a Saturday game to a Sunday game, what is the variable that is actually changing?
The variables that fluctuate, the ones that dictate whether you play well or poorly on any given day, are your decision speed, your attentional focus, and your composure under extreme fatigue.
Those are the high variance variables.
Exactly.
Which provides the perfect bridge to our first major psychological mechanism.
Mm.
Let's look at the anatomy of a mistake. Let's say you are out there on the ice. You are 40 seconds into a grueling shift. You try to make a pass up the middle, and you turn the puck over. The other team gets a scoring chance. You manage to get off the ice and sit on the bench. You are furious with yourself. What is actually happening neurologically in that moment?
To understand the damage a mistake causes, we have to look at attentional control theory. When you make a mistake, the immediate emotional response is anxiety or frustration.
Sure.
Now, we often think of anxiety just as a bad feeling, you know, an unpleasant emotion. But attentional control theory posits that anxiety is actually a cognitive load. It literally consumes the limited processing power of your brain's central executive.
The central executive. Yeah. So if we are using a computer analogy, this is the CPU. It is the part of the brain that manages working memory, directs attention, and decides what information is important right now.
That is a highly accurate comparison. Your central executive has a finite amount of RAM, or working memory. And this theory shows that anxiety specifically degrades two vital functions of that central executive.
Okay, what are they?
First, it degrades the inhibition function. Inhibition is your brain's ability to block out irrelevant distractions, like the crowd shouting or the pain in your legs.
Okay.
Second, anxiety degrades the shifting function. Shifting is your ability to move your attention seamlessly from one thing to another, like looking from the puck carrier to the open player back door.
So let's map this onto our hypothetical player sitting on the bench. If I am sitting there and I am furious, rerunning that turnover over and over in my head, I am literally eating up my brain's RAM.
You are.
I am degrading my own inhibition and shifting functions.
Yes, you are actively blinding yourself to the present reality. Because your central executive is completely saturated with a replay of the past error, it cannot process new vital information.
You might be staring at the ice, but you aren't actually seeing the game.
Precisely. You can't analyze the line matchups the other team is putting out. You can't process the tactical adjustments your coach is drawing on the whiteboard. Mm. By ruminating on the bench, one bad shift literally guarantees a second bad shift. You carry the cognitive load of the mistake into the future.
Ensuring your decision-making will be slow when you step back on the ice. So if the problem is a saturated working memory, how do we flush the RAM? How do we clear that cognitive load before the next shift starts?
This is where we get into the four-step shift reset.
Right. And listener, remember our epistemology buckets from earlier.
Mm-hmm.
This exact four-step sequence is technically coaching craft because nobody has run a 10-year university study on this specific routine as a whole.
But every single individual step within the routine is deeply grounded in physiological and psychological science. It is a synthesis of best practices.
Let's walk through it. Step one of the reset is to use a physical trigger. The manual suggests something like tapping your shin pads with your stick, or splashing water on your face, or aggressively tightening your Velcro straps. Now, I want to push back on this a little bit.
Okay, go ahead.
Why does it have to be physical? If this is a mental problem, a cognitive load issue, why can't I just think to myself, okay, reset, let it go?
Because the brain is incredibly adept at ignoring vague internal instructions, especially under the influence of adrenaline. A physical action serves as an anchor. It makes the reset a definitive, undeniable starting point.
So it's concrete.
Exactly. It moves the concept of a reset from being a passive mood you were hoping to eventually feel into an active, concrete behavior that you execute. It is the difference between saying, I hope I wake up early, and physically setting an alarm clock. The physical trigger signals to the nervous system that a transition is occurring.
That makes a lot of sense. You are dragging the brain back into the physical body. So step two is a specific breathing protocol. One long exhale. Not a deep breath in, but a prolonged slow breath out.
And this is where we dip heavily into bucket one, robust peer-reviewed science. There was a massive meta-analysis that pooled data from hundreds of different studies to figure out what voluntary slow breathing actually does to the human body.
And what did they find?
They found that a prolonged exhale specifically increases vagally mediated heart rate variability.
The vagus nerve. This is the superhighway of the parasympathetic nervous system, right? The system responsible for rest and digest, which is the exact opposite of the fight or flight sympathetic nervous system.
That is the core mechanism. When you inhale, your heart rate naturally speeds up slightly. When you exhale, your heart rate slows down.
Mm-hmm.
By intentionally prolonging the exhale, you are mechanically stimulating that vagus nerve. The vagus nerve then acts as a biological brake pedal, sending a signal directly to your heart to slow down. You are physiologically forcing the adrenaline and cortisol spike caused by your mistake to drop.
Now, let's be intellectually honest and check our buckets here. The manual notes a caveat, which is that the evidence for this breathing technique directly improving performance on the very next shift is a bit thin.
We absolutely must be precise about the claims. Breathing slowly will not magically make you score a goal on your next shift.
Right. It's not magic.
The direct line to performance enhancement is difficult to prove in a lab. However, the evidence that it changes your physiological state is undeniable. It pulls you out of a catastrophic fight or flight response, lowering your heart rate and restoring some of that lost executive function. It basically stops the bleeding.
So we have our physical anchor and our physiological brake pedal.
Oh.
Step three of the reset is using a cue word.
Yeah.
Saying something internally to yourself, like next, or feet, or patience.
And there is a massive scientific nuance here regarding how self-talk actually works.
Right, because for a long time, people thought any positive self-talk was good. But the science demonstrated something called the matching hypothesis.
The matching hypothesis fundamentally changes how we should construct our internal monologues. It found that the type of keyword you use must match the physical demand of the task you are about to perform.
So it's not one size fits all.
Not at all. Broadly speaking, there are instructional cues and motivational cues. Instructional cues are highly specific directives, like look over your shoulder, or stay low, or follow through.
And the research shows instructional cues are best for fine motor skills, right? Tasks requiring extreme precision and technique, like taking a face-off in hockey or placing a delicate pass.
Or, outside of sports, carefully typing a complex line of code.
Correct. But what if I use an instructional cue for a gross motor skill? A task requiring massive blunt effort.
It actually hinders you. For gross, effortful tasks, like fighting for a loose puck along the wall or simply grinding out the last 20 seconds of an exhausting shift when your lungs are burning, you need motivational cues. Words like work, go, push, or battle.
It is about optimizing the signal you are sending your muscles. You don't tell your body to be precise when what you actually need is raw horsepower.
Exactly.
Okay, that brings us to step four of the reset, which the material argues is the most vital component of all. Name the next action. Why is stating a concrete plan so crucial to clearing the mental slate?
Because of the limitations of the working memory we discussed earlier, nature abhors a vacuum, and so does the central executive. If you tap your pads, exhale, say a cue word, and then just sit there, your brain will almost immediately default back to replaying the turnover.
Because it doesn't have anything else to do.
Right. You cannot hold two competing thoughts in your working memory simultaneously. By forcing yourself to name a concrete, specific action for your next shift, for example, telling yourself, on this next shift, I'm going to take the inside shoulder of the opposing defenseman, you are giving your brain a new job.
You are actively displacing the mental replay of the error by occupying the RAM with a blueprint for the future.
You are replacing rumination with tactical planning.
Which brings up a really fascinating danger. The trap of suppression. My instinct, and I think most people's instinct, if I make an embarrassing mistake, is to sit on the bench and think, don't think about the turnover. Stop thinking about how bad that looked. Just forget it.
And that is arguably the most counterproductive thing you can do. The classic psychological phenomenon here is the white bear problem.
Oh, right. This is a famous one.
Yeah. If I tell you, whatever you do, do not think of a white bear, you have to conjure the image of a white bear in order to monitor whether you are successfully not thinking about it.
Right. You're thinking about it to make sure you're not thinking about it.
Exactly. Thought suppression is incredibly effortful. It uses up the exact attentional capacity, that shifting and inhibition RAM that you desperately need to be observing the ongoing game.
So trying to suppress the thought of the mistake actually causes the exact same cognitive overload as ruminating on the mistake. That is a brutal catch-22. Mm. So how does the manual suggest we handle the intrusive thought of the error if we can't suppress it?
The material points to the MSC approach, which stands for a mindfulness acceptance commitment.
Now, let's check the epistemology buckets again. The evidence for the acceptance part of this theory is actually quite thin, right?
We have to be rigorous here, yes. The idea that actively accepting your negative emotions improves performance is not scientifically settled. However, the mindfulness aspect of the MSC approach, the simple act of noticing the thought without engaging with it, has very strong evidence.
So the practical application is this. Mm-hmm. You notice the thought of the mistake creeping in. You acknowledge it. Yes, I turned the puck over. That happened.
Bruh.
You allow the thought to exist without fighting it or suppressing it, and then you commit your attention to the next action anyway.
You let the thought sit in the passenger seat, but you do not let it grab the steering wheel.
I love that visual. Let's do a quick recap for the listener to solidify this mechanism. The structured shift reset to clear your cognitive load and flush your brain's RAM after a mistake is, first, a physical trigger to anchor the moment.
Right.
Second, a long exhale to stimulate the vagus nerve and apply the physiological brake pedal. Third, a cue word matched to the demands of the upcoming task. And fourth, naming a concrete next action to displace the memory of the error. Do not fight the ghost of the last shift. Give your brain a new job.
That is a highly functional synthesis. And, you know, understanding that we must give the brain a new job leads us directly into our next major topic. We need to discuss what that new job should actually look like. We need to talk about goal setting and focus, specifically the crucial distinction between process and outcome.
This is a distinction that, frankly, alters how you approach any challenge in life, not just sports. Let's define the terms. An outcome goal is a target that you do not fully control. scoring a goal, winning a hockey game, getting a promotion at work, or closing a massive sales deal. You can influence these things, but you do not have ultimate authority over them.
Right.
A process goal, on the other hand, is an action that is entirely within your control. It is the route you take to the puck, keeping your feet moving on the back check, or, in hockey terms, defending a rush with a gap of exactly 2 to 3 stick lengths.
The fundamental danger of focusing heavily on outcome goals is that outcomes are incredibly noisy environments.
Noisy meaning there is a high degree of luck or external variables involved.
Precisely. In hockey, you can play a shift absolutely perfectly. You make the right defensive read, you steal the puck, you execute a mechanically flawless wrist shot, you beat the goaltender, and the puck hits the inside of the goalpost and bounces out.
Right. You did everything right and still failed to score.
Exactly. But if your only metric for success was the outcome scoring the goal, your brain registers that entire sequence as a failure. Your confidence takes a massive hit that it fundamentally has not earned because your process was perfect.
You are punishing yourself for the physics of a bouncing piece of rubber.
Yes.
But the danger of outcome focus goes much deeper than just unfair self-criticism. Focusing on the outcome can actually be the direct mechanism that causes you to fail in the first place. This brings us to a fascinating concept, explicit monitoring theory.
This theory explains the anatomy of choking under pressure.
Oh, this is so interesting.
It really is. When you are deeply worried about an outcome like winning a championship or impressing a scout, that worry creates psychological pressure. Pressure induces self-consciousness. It forces your brain to start explicitly monitoring your own physical movements to ensure you don't mess up.
Which sounds like a good thing, right? Being careful and monitoring your movements.
Yeah.
But it is actually a disaster for an athlete.
It is a disaster because of how the brain stores physical skills.
Mm.
For an automated proceduralized skill like a golf putt, a tennis serve, or a hockey wrist shot, your brain has spent thousands of hours moving that movement pattern from the conscious explicit memory into the subconscious implicit memory.
So it's automatic.
Yes. Your basal ganglia and motor cortex know how to execute the shot without you having to think about it.
I always think of the centipede's dilemma. A centipede walked perfectly fine with 100 legs. But if you ask the centipede, hey, how exactly do you move your 37th left leg in coordination with your 12th right leg?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the moment the centipede tries to consciously manage a subconscious process to ensure a perfect outcome, it trips over itself.
That is the exact mechanism. When you consciously monitor an automated skill, you break its fluency. You force the brain to bypass the efficient subconscious motor pathways and route the movement through the slower, clunkier conscious working memory.
Wow.
You literally turn a smooth, fast, expert action into a slow, deliberate, novice action. That is what choking is.
So an obsessive outcome focus makes you watch yourself perform, and the act of watching yourself perform destroys the performance. That is mind-blowing.
It really changes how you think about pressure.
It does. Now, speaking of where we place our focus, we have to talk about what might be the biggest scientific bombshell in this entire deep dive. This is a story about how science corrects itself. Let's talk about the replication crisis in external focus.
This is a phenomenal example of why we must rigorously examine our evidence buckets. For years, decades even, the absolute gold standard in sports psychology and motor learning was the theory of external focus.
Let's define that. The theory stated that when you are giving yourself a cue or focusing on a movement, your attention should always point outside your body. So instead of using an internal focus, like telling yourself to bend your knees or snap your wrists, you should use an external focus, like drive the ice away or shoot at the target.
And this wasn't just a fringe theory. It was foundational. A massive meta-analysis published in 2021 seemed to support this heavily, showing significant performance benefits when athletes used external rather than internal focus. Coaches around the world changed how they taught skills based on this doctrine.
But then 2024 happens.
Yes. A paper is published in 2024 that drops a hammer on this entire paradigm. They conducted a robust Bayesian reanalysis of the existing literature.
Let's slow down and unpack that for a listener who might not be deep into statistics.
Yeah.
What is a Bayesian reanalysis and what did they actually find?
In simple terms, a Bayesian reanalysis involves taking our prior knowledge about a subject and then looking at the data again using advanced statistical models that can detect flaws in how the original research was reported. What this team was looking for was publication bias.
The file drawer problem.
Exactly. Publication bias occurs when academic journals preferentially publish studies that find an exciting, positive result, like, you know, external focus makes you jump 10% higher. and they reject or ignore studies that find no effect.
And those boring studies get shoved into a file drawer and never see the light of day.
Right. When the researchers mathematically corrected the data for this severe publication bias, the supposed massive benefit of external focus dropped to essentially zero.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
They checked the math, found out researchers were mostly only publishing studies that proved the external focus theory while hiding the ones that didn't, and realized the entire theory was largely a statistical mirage.
Yes, it completely upended the accepted wisdom.
So what is the takeaway for our listener? If years of dogma about always focus externally are wrong, what should a player actually do?
The takeaway is incredibly liberating and practical. Ignore the dogmatic advice. The science now suggests that the best focus is highly individualized. You should use whatever cue wording actually helps you feel the physical correction you are trying to make.
So if an internal cue works, use it.
Exactly. If you are struggling with your shot and telling yourself to snap your wrists, a strictly internal cue results in a better release, use it. Do not force an awkward external metaphor just because a textbook told you to.
Use whatever language actually translates into physical execution. So bring this back to our broader discussion of process versus outcome goals. If outcome goals cause choking and are full of noisy variables, do we just completely abandon them? Do we stop caring about the score entirely?
No, we don't swing the pendulum completely in the other direction. Research on goal-setting combinations has shown that relying only on process goals is not optimal.
Why not?
Well, an athlete with only process goals can sometimes lose their competitive edge or their broader sense of direction. The best results, the highest levels of performance and motivation, came from utilizing a combination of process, performance, and outcome goals.
So how do we integrate that practically?
The practical application is this. You must judge your immediate success, evaluate your night, and base your self-worth on your process goals. Did you execute the defensive gaps you could control? Did you keep your feet moving? That is your engine. But you keep the outcome goal, winning the game, making the playoffs in the mix, as your directional compass.
Process is the engine that drives the car. Outcome is the map that tells you where you are going. You can't stare at the map while you're driving or you'll crash.
That's a great analogy.
Okay, let's take a breath, because we are moving into a concept that radically redefines a buzzword we hear constantly. Let's look at the mechanics of confidence.
We need to destroy the cultural idea that confidence is simply believing in yourself or looking in the mirror and saying positive affirmations.
It's not a mood.
No, confidence is not a mood. Confidence has a rigid biological and psychological architecture. The definitive framework for understanding this is Albert Bandura's theory of self-efficacy.
Self-efficacy being defined as your specific belief in your capacity to execute a specific task, like I might have high self-efficacy for riding a bicycle, but zero self-efficacy for landing a helicopter.
Correct. It is context-dependent. And Bandura identified four distinct sources that build this efficacy, and crucially, he ranked them by their power.
Let's walk through this hierarchy. Number one, the absolute strongest, undeniable source of confidence. Mastery experiences.
Mastery experiences are exactly what they sound like. It is the act of having actually done the thing successfully in the past. Not imagining it, not reading a book about it, not watching a YouTube tutorial. Physically executing the task.
Because it's proof.
Yes. When you execute a task successfully, it provides undeniable neurological proof to your brain that you are capable. Your brain logs it as historical fact. No amount of self-doubt can argue with a mastery experience.
Number two on the hierarchy. Vicarious experience.
This is watching someone else perform the task successfully. But there is a massive caveat here that most people miss.
Yes.
Watching an elite generational professional execute a complex move does not significantly build your confidence because your brain fundamentally cannot relate to them. You know they possess physical tools you do not.
So who do you watch?
Vicarious efficacy is only built when you watch a peer, someone who you perceive to be at exactly your skill level, succeed at the task. Your brain says, if they can do it, given we are equal, I must be able to do it too.
Number three, verbal persuasion. Being told you can do it by a coach, a parent, or a teammate. And I really want to highlight a brutal psychological asymmetry here. The research shows that discouragement damages your confidence far more easily and far more deeply than encouragement builds it up.
It takes a tremendous amount of positive verbal persuasion to move the needle on your confidence. But a single sharp negative comment from an authority figure can entirely collapse it.
One sarcastic comment from a coach can wipe out five compliments. It is a fragile source of confidence. And finally, the fourth source, physiological state. But as the manual points out, it is not the state itself that dictates confidence. It is how you interpret the state.
Right. The physical sensation of a racing heart, sweaty palms, and a tight stomach is biologically identical, whether you are terrified or thrilled.
It's wild to think about.
If you interpret those sensations as anxiety, your self-efficacy plummets. If you interpret them as your body mobilizing resources and priming itself for battle, your self-efficacy remains stable or even rises.
We will dig much deeper into that interpretation mechanism when we talk about nerves shortly. But right now, let's look at how confidence actually collapses in real time. Let's map this hierarchy onto the anatomy of a scoring slump in hockey.
A slump is a textbook vicious cycle of degrading self-efficacy. It usually starts with bad luck, a hot opposing goalie, or a few shots hitting the post. The player's outcome goals are frustrated.
And the response is usually to change how they play, right?
Yes. The player's psychological response to this lack of outcome is almost always to decide to be more careful. They feel their confidence slipping, so they don't want to waste chances. They decide they will only shoot when they have the perfect opportunity.
Which means practically they shoot the puck far less often.
Precisely. And by shooting less, they drastically shrink their sample size. In statistics, when you have a tiny sample size, variance and noise reign supreme.
Oh, I see where this is going.
In hockey terms, by refusing to shoot unless it's perfect, the player misses out on the ugly goals. The lucky deflections, the rebounds off the goalie's pads, the weird bounces that usually break a slump. Because they aren't shooting, they hold onto the puck longer, trying to manufacture the perfect play. They carry the puck into contact with defenders.
Which inevitably leads to a turnover. And the turnover provides a negative mastery experience. That damages their confidence even further, making them even more careful, causing them to shoot even less. The loop tightens like a boa constrictor. So, to our listener, if you find yourself trapped in this loop, whether that is a scoring slump in hockey, a cold streak in sales, or a severe creative block in writing, how do you actually break it?
You have to hack Bender's hierarchy. If we know scientifically that mastery experiences are the strongest source of confidence, you cannot wait for them to happen organically. You must manufacture them.
How do you do that?
The clinical fix for a slump is to change your goals. You set a rigid process goal of taking, for example, 5 shots a game, completely regardless of the quality of the shot or the location on the ice. You must force the volume up to rebuild the sample size and invite positive variance back into your game.
You're forcing your body to take the actions of a confident player, hoping the brain follows.
Yes. Furthermore, you must temporarily change your unit of success. If scoring a goal is your only acceptable metric for success during a slump, you will starve to death psychologically. You have to lower the threshold for a mastery experience.
Okay, so you change the metric.
You change the unit of success to battles won along the boards or successful defensive zone clearances. You build a bank account of micro successes to stabilize your baseline confidence before returning to the larger goal.
You give your brain undeniable proof of competence in a different, highly controllable area to stop the psychological bleeding.
I love that. It makes confidence a mechanical process rather than a mysterious aura. All right, let's move into a topic that completely upends what most of us learned in high school psychology. Let's unpack arousal, nerves, and the inverted U.
Oh, the inverted U. Anyone who has taken a Psych 101 class has seen the inverted U curve, also known as the Yerkes-Dodson law. The graph looks like a bell curve.
Right. The basic premise is that if your arousal level is 0, you are asleep or completely bored, your performance is terrible. If your arousal is at maximum, you are in a state of sheer panic, your performance is also terrible. The theory dictates that you want to be right in the middle, at the peak of the curve, in the sweet spot of moderate arousal. It is an incredibly elegant theory, which is why it is in every textbook. It is also one of the most widely misunderstood and misapplied concepts in the history of sports psychology.
First of all, the history of where this law came from is wild. The foundational 1908 study wasn't conducted on elite athletes under pressure. It was conducted on Japanese dancing mice that were being electroshocked to see how fast they could learn a maze.
It is a phenomenal detail that highlights the danger of uncritically transferring animal learning models to complex human sports.
It really does.
But the critical context that the textbooks almost always omit is that the inverted U curve only applies to complex, unfamiliar, or highly cognitive tasks.
Okay, so what about physical tasks?
When a task is simple, highly proceduralized, and heavily physical, like engaging in a violent puck battle on the boards, or executing a maximal effort forecheck, the curve changes completely. For those gross motor tasks, performance scales almost linearly with physiological arousal. Higher arousal generally equals better performance.
So if a coach sees a player physically trembling with adrenaline before a game and tells them to calm down and take deep breaths to get back to the middle of the inverted U, the coach is actively making the player worse.
Yes, they are bleeding off the horsepower required for the task. The inverted U fails to capture the reality of high-contact sports. The model that much more accurately explains how athletes actually fall apart under pressure is the catastrophe model.
The catastrophe model is fascinating because it forces us to split nervousness into two distinct categories: cognitive anxiety and physiological arousal.
That distinction is the entire engine of the theory. Physiological arousal is the biological reality. Your heart beating 150 times a minute, adrenaline flooding your bloodstream, your muscles tensing.
In cognitive anxiety.
Cognitive anxiety is the mental reality. Worry, catastrophizing, negative self-talk, fear of failure. The catastrophe model demonstrates that if you have exceptionally high physiological arousal, but your cognitive anxiety is low, meaning you're pumped up but your mind is clear, you will actually perform at a phenomenally high level.
But what happens when you combine them? What happens when a player's heart rate is maxed out and suddenly their brain is flooded with catastrophic worry about making a mistake?
That is where the model gets its name. When high physiological arousal meets high cognitive anxiety, your performance does not gently slide down the backside of a bell curve.
It crashes.
It falls off a cliff.
Yeah.
It is an immediate catastrophic drop in physical coordination, tactical awareness, and decision-making speed. The player completely unravels in real time.
And what makes this terrifying is the concept of the hysteresis effect. Let's make sure we clearly explain this because it dictates how you have to recover from a meltdown.
Hysteresis is a concept we borrowed from physics. Broadly, it means that the path back up is not the same as the path you took down.
Right.
Imagine a rubber band that has been stretched so far, it loses its elasticity. You can't just release the tension a tiny bit and expect it to snap back to its original shape. You have to let it go completely slack. In psychological terms, once an athlete has fallen off that catastrophe cliff, they cannot recover simply by calming down a little bit.
If they were operating at a 9 out of 10 on the arousal scale when they crashed, they can't just take a breath, drop to an 8, and expect to play well again.
No. To reset the system and regain their performance baseline, they have to drop their physiological arousal way, way below the point at which they crashed. They have to force a massive physiological deceleration.
This is the exact scientific justification for NHL Rule 87.1, the 30-second timeout.
It is.
Think about it. A team gets trapped in their own zone. They are exhausted, they get scored on, the next shift, they are frantic, panicking, running around, and they get scored on again. They have fallen off the catastrophe cliff. The coach calls a timeout. The coach isn't drawing up a complex tactical play on the whiteboard. The coach is utilizing the hysteresis effect. They are forcing the team to stand still for 30 seconds to artificially drop their heart rates back to the floor, allowing the system to reset so they can rebuild their arousal without the cognitive panic.
It is a biological circuit breaker. Now, understanding that arousal affects everyone differently brings us to the concept of individual zones of optimal functioning, or IZOF. The core premise here is that there is no universal optimal curve. Every single athlete has a unique, highly specific emotional and physiological state where they perform their best.
Some players play their absolute best when they are completely serene, quiet, and smiling before a game. Other players play their best when they are furious, pacing the locker room, and looking like they want to fight someone.
And neither approach is inherently wrong, provided it matches that specific individual's biological zone.
So, listener, your practical application here is to become a clinician of your own biology. You need to track your emotional state. Before your next 8 games or 8 major presentations, write down exactly how you feel. Are you angry, calm, anxious, energetic? Then, after the event, ruthlessly rate your performance. Over time, you will map out your specific optimal zone.
And the biggest mistake you can make is trying to copy the pregame routine of a teammate or colleague whose zone is fundamentally different from yours. It requires deep self-awareness.
Definitely.
And a crucial part of that self-awareness is delineating between normal nerves and destructive anxiety. Nerves are physiological readiness. Your body is mobilizing resources, glucose, oxygen, adrenaline to prepare you for a difficult task. Anxiety is the cognitive catastrophizing we discussed in the catastrophe model.
If you feel those intense physical nerves, the manual offers a brilliant psychological trick. It is called arousal, reappraisal.
Reappraisal is incredibly powerful. Imagine you are standing on the blue line waiting for the national anthem to finish before a championship game. Your heart is pounding out of your chest. Your stomach is entirely in knots. The default human reaction is to think, oh no, I am so nervous, I'm going to play terribly, I need to calm down.
But the research says you should actively change the label you are putting on that physical sensation. Instead of identifying it as fear, you say out loud to yourself, that is my body getting ready. That is the adrenaline I need to be fast tonight.
You are taking the exact same physiological sensation and simply changing the narrative framing. And as we learned from the fourth source of confidence earlier, it is the interpretation of the physiological state that dictates whether it builds you up or breaks you down. You are weaponizing your nerves instead of fighting them.
Okay, let's zoom out. We've covered cognitive load, the working memory reset, process goals, the architecture of confidence, and the catastrophe model of arousal. Let's look at how a player structures all of this architecture before the puck even drops. Let's dive into routines, superstitions, and focus quadrants.
If we look at the meta-analytic evidence, the data is unambiguous. Pre-game routines work. They have a significant, measurable, positive effect on performance.
Yeah.
And this holds true regardless of the athlete's skill level, from amateurs to Olympic veterans.
Why do they work so well?
Yep. The primary function of a routine is to make your internal psychological state consistent, so that the only variables you have to process are the external variables of the game itself. It is about reducing cognitive load. If your warm-up is automated, your brain doesn't have to spend energy deciding what to do next.
But there is a massive trap here that I see all the time in sports, which is confusing a functional routine with a superstition. The source material gives us a brilliant, frankly brutal, litmus test to tell the difference.
It's a great test.
Listener, examine your own pre-game or pre-performance habits and ask yourself this single question. If I am somehow prevented from doing this specific action, does it wreck my composure?
That is the defining line. If missing your specific pair of lucky socks, or if you are a goalie and someone interrupts you while you were tapping the goalposts exactly 3 times, ruins your mental state and makes you feel like you are destined to play poorly. You do not have a routine. You have a superstition.
And why is a superstition dangerous? Because you have literally outsourced your composure, your self-efficacy, to a variable entirely outside of your control. If the washing machine breaks and your socks aren't clean, your confidence collapses.
Which is why you must aggressively prune superstitions from your life. A true functional routine, like a dynamic physical warm-up or a structured visualization exercise, can be compressed, modified, or even skipped if the bus is late, and the athlete will still retain their baseline composure.
Speaking of visualization within a routine, if you are going to use imagery, you must ensure it is actually effective. The prevailing scientific framework for functional visualization is the PEDAL8 model.
The core thesis of that model is what matters, which is functional equivalence.
Meaning what?
Meaning the brain only benefits from imagery if the imagery closely mimics the actual neurological firing of the physical task. Visualizing yourself lazily skating around an empty, silent rink in slow motion does absolutely nothing. The imagery must be realistic. You should ideally perform it while wearing your actual gear to trigger the sensory associations. It must be visualized in real-time speed, not cinematic slow motion. And crucially, it must include the actual visceral emotions of the game. You must visualize the physical strain, the noise of the crowd, the fatigue in your legs.
It has to be a full bandwidth simulation. Now, once the game actually starts, how do we direct our attention?
Mm-hmm.
We need to look at the brain's spotlight. Robert Nitifer created a brilliant framework called the 4 kinds of focus. He built a grid based on 2 intersecting dimensions.
The first dimension is width. Is your focus broad, taking in a wide field of information, or is it narrow, zooming in on one specific detail?
Okay.
The second dimension is direction. Is your focus external, looking out at the physical environment, or internal, looking inside your own head at your thoughts and feelings?
This intersection creates 4 distinct quadrants of focus. Let's map them to a hockey game.
Yep.
Broad external focus is reading the entire ice, seeing the whole play develop, noting where all 10 skaters are positioned.
Right.
Narrow external focus is locking onto one highly specific target in the environment, like tracking the puck as it comes off a teammate's stick to receive a fast pass.
Yes.
Broad internal focus is analytical. It is sitting on the bench, planning tactics, integrating the coach's feedback, and evaluating the game plan. And finally, narrow internal focus is tuning into the physical proprioceptive feel of a specific movement right before you do it, like feeling the tension in your wrists before a face-off.
Every single one of those quadrants is vital. And the absolute key insight here, the thing that separates elite performers from amateurs, is that being a focused player isn't about having a really strong, unbroken, narrow external focus.
That's usually what people think focus is.
Right, but the actual skill is the ability to switch between these quadrants fluidly and seamlessly as the environment demands.
Like a defenseman backing up to defend a rush. They must be in broad external to see the passing options. But the millisecond they decide to step up and physically engage the puck carrier, their brain must snap violently into narrow external to execute the stick check.
Exactly. If they fail to switch quadrants in that fraction of a second, they miss the puck. Which perfectly explains one of the most frustrating phenomena in hockey, puck watching.
I love this analysis. Puck watching is when a player, usually a defender, just stares blankly at the puck carrier and completely loses track of the opposing player sneaking in right behind them for a backdoor goal. Coaches constantly yell at players for this. They frame it as a laziness problem or a lack of effort. You aren't trying hard enough, you're just watching the puck.
But this manual reframes it entirely. It is not a moral failure or a laziness failure.
It's cognitive.
It is a predictable cognitive failure. The puck is the brightest, fastest-moving object in a highly chaotic environment. Millions of years of human evolutionary biology have designed our visual attention system to automatically lock onto exactly that kind of high-threat, fast-moving stimulus. Puck watching is simply the brain getting biologically trapped in the narrow external quadrant.
And let's connect this back to our very first topic,
yep.
Attentional control theory. We established earlier that cognitive anxiety directly degrades the central executive's shifting function.
Precisely the connection we need to make. If a player is highly anxious, their brain literally loses the RAM required to shift their focus away from the brightest object. Therefore, a nervous, tight player is biologically predestined to get trapped in narrow external focus and become a puck watcher. You cannot fix this biological reality by simply yelling, "Concentrate!" from the bench.
You fix it by training specific mechanical physical triggers to force the quadrant shift. You train a defenseman that every time an opposing player crosses the blue line, they must physically turn their chin to their shoulder to check their blind spot. You train the physical behavior to override the anxious biology.
It is a profound shift in how we understand mistakes. You are fighting biology, exacerbated by anxiety, not a lack of character or effort.
Let's move into an area that requires a lot of honesty. We need to talk about the psychology of fear and injury. And the very first thing we have to do is normalize this. Because there is a lot of machismo in sports that pretends fear doesn't exist.
It is rarely discussed openly, but the fear of physical contact, the fear of being hit by the puck, and the deep fear of making a humiliating mistake are incredibly common, especially in adult, recreational, and youth hockey.
And we must immediately validate that fear. It is a completely rational, evolutionary response. You are moving at high speeds on a low-friction surface, surrounded by immovable wooden boards and flying vulcanized rubber.
To not have some level of baseline fear would indicate a lack of self-preservation. But the fear of making a mistake is the most insidious, because it creates a devastating behavioral paradox.
Let's look at how fear actually dictates play. If you are terrified of making a mistake that leads to a goal, your instinct is to play safe. You chip the puck away immediately when you get it. You refuse to accept a tight pass in traffic. You back away from physical battles.
And by attempting to play perfectly safe, you introduce hesitation into your game. In a fast-paced, high-pressure environment, hesitation is the single mistake that gets punished the hardest. That extra half second of hesitation when deciding to pinch on a loose puck allows the opposing defender to close the gap and blow past you.
So the passive, fearful player actually generates more turnovers and odd man rushes against their team. And those failures then serve as negative mastery experiences, confirming their original fear that they are prone to mistakes and shouldn't take risks. It is a brutal, self-fulfilling prophecy.
So how do we actually treat this fear? We look to clinical psychology. The standard treatment for phobias and acute fear is graded exposure.
Graded exposure meaning progressively harder, controlled contact with the stimulus you fear, but crucially at a level where you remain in control of the situation.
Exactly. In hockey, you do not cure a player's fear of physical contact by throwing them into a full-speed, full-contact scrimmage and telling them to toughen up. That will only traumatize them further and reinforce the fear. You start with stationary, controlled, leaning against the boards. Once their nervous system accepts that as safe, you move to half-speed angling drills. then controlled, predictable stick checks. You only move up a level in intensity when the current level becomes boring to the nervous system.
And the manual makes a profound, highly practical point here. Technique is courage. You decrease your psychological fear by genuinely decreasing your actual physical risk of injury through proper mechanics.
If you do not know how to absorb a body check safely, your fear of being hit is not an irrational phobia. It is an entirely justified appraisal of real danger. The technique for taking a hit is non-negotiable, and it revolves around spinal safety. Head up, chin off your chest.
Explain the mechanics of the chin, because every kid growing up hears coaches yell, "Get low, get low." And players interpret that incorrectly.
Right. Get low to lower your center of gravity is correct advice, but players often achieve that low posture by bending over at the waist and tucking their chin tightly to their chest.
Which is dangerous.
Very. From a biomechanical standpoint, tucking your chin straightens the cervical spine, the bones in your neck. If you are driven into the boards head first with the straight cervical spine, it cannot absorb shock, and the risk of a severe catastrophic fracture skyrockets.
Oh, wow.
You must achieve a low posture by bending your knees while keeping your head up and your cervical spine in its natural, slightly curved alignment. Furthermore, you keep your skates parallel to the boards, never pointing directly at them, and take the impact on the broad, muscular surfaces of your forearm and hip.
Technique is courage, and the same applies to the terrifying act of intentionally blocking a shot. Never turn your back to the shooter. Never turn sideways, which exposes your unprotected ribs. Never lift a leg like a flamingo, which exposes the inside of your knee.
Right. You square up perfectly to the shooter, present the heavily armored shin pads, and keep your head up and out of the shooting lane. If your technique is perfect, the armor takes the blow and the risk of injury plummets.
But I do want to note a crucial caveat the material provides. Do not suppress fear that signals genuine physical danger.
That is a vital distinction. If you see a player accelerating toward you from behind outside your field of vision and you feel a spike of fear, listen to it. Brace yourself or evade. That is your biology keeping you alive. You only use cognitive tools to suppress fear in situations that you know are mechanically safe.
Which provides a perfect transition to our next section. We have spent a lot of time inside the individual player's head. Now we need to look at the people around them. Let's talk about goaltenders, teammates, and coaches. Let's start with the goalie, arguably the most psychologically fascinating position in sports.
It is structurally isolating. You are on the team, but you play a fundamentally different game than everyone else on the ice. But I must note an epistemological caveat here. The robust, peer-reviewed literature specifically focusing on the psychology of ice hockey goaltenders is shockingly thin.
Really?
Yeah. A major scoping review looked at goalkeepers in soccer and found almost no rigorously tested psychological interventions. So the advice we discuss here relies heavily on structured coaching craft and extrapolated psychological principles.
But the psychological burden of the position is obvious. When a forward makes a bad pass in the neutral zone, maybe nothing happens. The play moves on. When a goalie makes a mistake, a red light goes off, 10,000 people scream, and the mistake is permanently recorded on the scoreboard for the rest of the night.
And then they just have to stand there.
Just stand there.
That standing there is the crux of the psychological trauma. Following a goal, a forward goes back to the bench and can talk to a coach. The goalie stands in the crease, alone and in silence, for 30 to 60 seconds while the officials retrieve the puck and the teams reset for the faceoff. They have absolutely no physical task to perform. It creates a massive, yawning vacuum for rumination.
The central executive gets completely hijacked by the memory of the mistake.
Exactly. So the clinical fix is the short memory routine. We have to artificially give the goalie a physical and cognitive task to fill that 60-second vacuum.
Similar to the shift reset.
Yes. Skate a specific loop around the face-off circles. Squirt the water bottle. Wipe the mask. Then state one highly factual, completely emotionless sentence about the physics of the goal. I was screened by the defenseman. I didn't track the release. You tap the post to anchor yourself back to the crease, and you reset.
You strip the emotion away and reduce the failure to geometry and physics. And for the teammates of that goalie, how you interact with them after a goal matters immensely.
The instinct is to be supportive. A goal goes in, and the defenseman skates up and taps the goalie on the pads to say, "My fault, keep your head up."
But if you do that after every single goal, you are accidentally communicating to the goalie that giving up a goal is a massive trauma that requires constant emotional management. The manual suggests treating the goal as unremarkable.
The best support is often to just skate away and get ready for the next shift, which subtly tells the goalie, Goals happen. It's not a disaster. Let's keep playing.
This concept of how we influence each other ties directly into the science of team dynamics and emotional contagion. A comprehensive review demonstrates that emotions spread incredibly rapidly through the social network of a sports team.
Think about the bench during a bad game. You get benched after a terrible shift. You sit down, you slump your shoulders, you stare at the rubber floor, and you shake your head in disgust. You think you are just having a private, internal moment of frustration.
But you are not. You are actively broadcasting defeat. In half a second, the player sitting next to you reads your postural body language. Their mirror neurons fire, and it subtly but tangibly alters their own emotional state and raises their own anxiety levels.
This is why elite teams enforce the concept of a neutral floor. You are allowed to feel frustrated internally, but your visible external baseline on the bench must remain upright, engaged, and neutral.
And beyond just the vibe of the bench, there is a literal, tangible scoreboard cost to losing your emotional control. The manual points to NHL rules regarding abusive officials and unsportsmanlike conduct. When you get slashed and no penalty is called, and you respond by banging your stick violently against the glass in frustration, that isn't just you venting or showing how much you care.
Under the rules, it is a minor penalty. By throwing a temper tantrum because you cannot regulate your own frustration, you literally hand the opposing team a 2-minute power play. Your lack of emotional control directly damages your team's mathematical probability of winning the game.
That is a harsh reality check. Now, dealing with teammates is one thing, but dealing with coaches requires a different kind of emotional regulation.
Yeah.
The key cognitive skill here is the ability to separate the message from the delivery.
This is a vital skill for any workplace, not just a hockey rink. A coach might scream at you in front of the entire team after a shift. The delivery is terrible. It is embarrassing, it might be toxic, and it is entirely unfair to you as a person. But the actual content of what they are screaming, you are leaving the front of the net completely exposed, might be 100% factually correct from a tactical standpoint.
If you let your ego discard the tactical message, just because you rightfully resent the aggressive delivery, you lose valuable information that could make you a better player. You punish yourself twice.
Conversely, you might have a coach who is incredibly nice, supportive, and communicative, but who gives you factually incorrect hockey advice. You have to intellectually separate the pleasant tone from the flawed data.
And if you find yourself benched and not getting ice time, the manual provides a fantastic proactive playbook. Most players wait a week, get angry, storm into the coach's office, and ask a vague defensive question like, why aren't I playing? What are you doing?
Which puts the coach on the defensive. Instead, the protocol is to wait 24 hours for the emotional temperature to drop. Then approach the coach and ask a highly specific, process-oriented question. Coach, what specific tactical action do I need to improve to earn time on the penalty kill?
This forces the coach to move away from vague criticisms and give you a tangible, measurable metric. Then, your job is to visibly execute that exact metric in the next 3 practices. You make your improvement undeniable.
Okay, we are entering the final stretch of our deep dive. Let's look at long-term motivation and, most importantly, when to seek real help. Let's start by exploding a massive cultural myth that has dominated the last decade of talent development, the 10,000 hours rule.
Popularized by Malcolm Gladwell, the idea was that roughly 10,000 hours of deliberate practice is the singular dividing line between an amateur and an elite expert. Practice makes perfect.
It is an appealing idea because it suggests total control. It suggests that if you just grind hard enough, you are guaranteed to reach the top. But the science paints a very different picture.
It really does.
A major 2016 meta-analysis investigated the actual impact of deliberate practice across various domains. They found that in sports, deliberate practice accounts for only roughly 18% of the variance in performance.
Wait, I want the listener to really hear that number. 18%.
Yes. That leaves 82% of the variance unaccounted for by practice hours.
So what's the other 82%?
That remaining 82% is dictated by genetic factors, starting age, the quality of coaching you had access to, your injury history, and the standard of the opponents you competed against.
Now, 18% is still a massive lever. It is the largest lever that you actually have control over, so you absolutely must practice. But the takeaway is that hours alone do not guarantee mastery, and comparing your trajectory to someone with different genetics or resources is mathematically illogical.
Furthermore, improvement during those hours is highly nonlinear. Players often hit a plateau where they don't seem to get any better for months, and they interpret that plateau as a failure of their practice routine.
When it's actually not.
Right. Cognitively, a plateau is often just a necessary period of consolidation. The brain is taking a complex, newly learned conscious skill and slowly myelinating the neural pathways to make it automatic. It looks like stagnation on the outside, but it is actually the mechanism that prevents the explicit monitoring and choking we discussed earlier.
That is deeply encouraging. But this discussion of mental strain leads us to the most critical distinction in this entire episode. We need to draw a hard, bright line between performance psychology and clinical psychology.
The International Olympic Committee released a comprehensive consensus statement on mental health in elite athletes. And their primary finding is crucial to understand. Athletes are not superheroes. The rates of clinical depression, anxiety, and substance abuse in elite athletes closely match the rates found in the general population.
Performance psychology, everything we have talked about today, like shift resets, arousal reappraisal, and focus quadrants, is about optimizing a fundamentally healthy brain to handle the highly specific artificial stressors of a game. It is a toolkit for the rink. It is absolutely not a treatment for clinical pathology.
The manual provides clear red flags to identify when a player has crossed that line. It is normal to feel nervous the morning of a big game, but if your anxiety starts 3 days before a meaningless Tuesday night game and completely ruins your sleep architecture, that is a red flag. If you feel a deep, lingering dread about going to the rink, that is a red flag.
And the most important metric, if the distress leaves the rink, a hockey problem should stay at the rink. If your frustration over a slump follows you home, alters your personality, affects your relationships with your family, or impacts your ability to hold down a job, it is no longer a hockey problem. It is a clinical issue.
And there is an absolute non-negotiable rule in this manual. Any thought of self-harm, any passive or active suicidal ideation, means you immediately stop worrying about hockey, you stop worrying about mental toughness, and you seek immediate professional clinical help.
If you are in the U.S. or Canada, that means dialing or texting 988. If you are in the U.K. or Ireland, the numbers are 999 or 116-1-3. Do not try to use a four-step breathing routine to cure clinical depression.
Exactly. Seeking a qualified psychiatrist or clinical psychologist is not a failure of athletic mental toughness. It is recognizing a medical necessity. You wouldn't try to cure a broken femur with positive self-talk, and you shouldn't try to cure clinical depression with it either.
Okay, we have covered an immense amount of ground today. We have mapped the diagnostic landscape of the mind. Let's move into our final mastery review. Let's synthesize everything we've learned into one grand integrated model.
If we step back and look at the entire framework, the mental game is fundamentally an exercise in managing cognitive load. Your central executive has limited processing power under the severe stress and fatigue of competition.
So we use the four-step shift reset, anchoring physically, exhaling to trigger the vagus nerve, matching a cue word, and stating a next action to actively flush the working memory and stop rumination from degrading our attentional capacity.
We utilize process goals focusing intensely on our controllable actions rather than the unpredictable outcome of the game to prevent the explicit monitoring that forces our brain to bypass automatic motor pathways, which is the root cause of choking.
We use the catastrophe model to understand that our biology can betray us. When cognitive anxiety and physical arousal combine, we fall off a cliff. And when we fall off that cliff, we understand the hysteresis effect. We need deep, prolonged physiological deceleration, like a 30-second timeout, to reset our baseline.
And finally, we use Nedeffer's four quadrants to understand that attention is dynamic. It isn't about staring hard. It is about shifting seamlessly between broad tactical awareness and narrow physical execution to avoid biological traps like puck watching.
So to you, the listener, as you walk away from this masterclass, if you only remember three foundational principles, let it be these. Number one, a mistake is never fixed by attempting to suppress the bad thought. It is fixed by a structured reset that ends by giving your brain a concrete, tactical next action to execute.
Number two, confidence is not magical thinking or empty affirmations. It is a biological log of past successes. It comes from manufactured mastery experiences. When you are in a slump, you must change your goals to build a high volume of undeniable proof through action.
And number three, hesitation, which is almost always caused by a deep fear of making a mistake, is the most heavily punished error in any fast-paced environment. Action, even imperfect action, is mathematically safer than passive hesitation.
That is a highly accurate functional synthesis of the applied science.
I want to leave you with a final provocative thought. Earlier, we talked about emotional contagion. We talked about how your slumping shoulders on the bench, your visible frustration, literally changes the biochemistry and raises the anxiety levels of the player sitting right next to you.
Yeah.
If that is scientifically true, then mental toughness is not just a selfish individual pursuit to make yourself look good. Regulating your own mind, managing your own anxiety, is actually an act of profound service to your team, to your family, and to your coworkers. How is your internal monologue right now affecting the nervous systems, the people around you?
That's a brilliant and challenging question to carry with you.
We started this deep dive talking about x-rays, how in medicine a broken bone is clean and visible, but the mind under pressure is murky. I hope that after spending this time with us, that diagnostic landscape of the mind looks a little less murky to you and a little more like an architecture you can actually understand, repair, and master. Thank you for joining us on the deep dive.